On today's episode, we're going to be talking about the changing climate. So we'll talk about the climate system, which is a key to detecting any climate change, the natural causes of climate change, the human impact on global climate, some climate feedback mechanisms, and then some consequences. Now, I always like to start with a discussion of the past because we don't know where we're going until we know where we've been. So the climate has always been changing, and there's evidence in the past, and we expect that to continue. 65 million years ago, it was warmer than it is now, and that's when the movie Jurassic Park kind of would be set, right? If it was real, then there would be a Jurassic Park back 65 million years ago, because that's when the dinosaurs were around. And then 55 million years ago, there was the cooling period, which led to the polar ice caps. 25 million years ago, the continental glaciers began at the beginning of the Pliocene epoch, and there was an alternating advance and retreat of glaciers, and the in-between periods are called interglacial periods. They would be the warmer periods when there was melting of the glaciers. 10 million years ago, ice began to form on Antarctica, and 2 million years ago, it was cold enough to support large ice sheets across North America, as far south as Kentucky. Now we move to thousands of years ago, so 18,000 years ago, there was maximum glacier thickness, and there was a Bering land bridge from Siberia to Alaska. So you probably heard the saying, I can see Russia from my house. Well, in this case, I can walk to Russia from my house. And many indigenous peoples and animals and creatures actually passed over this land bridge during that time period. And then 14,000 years ago, there was a worm spell called the Bowling Alarod. And then 12,700 years ago, there were back to the glacial periods called the Younger Dryas. And then at the end of that, 1,000 years later, there was a rapid rise in temperature of approximately 10 degrees C in Greenland in only 3 years. That is the maximum on our climate kind of graph here. And then 8,000 years ago, the mean temperature annually in Central Europe was negative 2 degrees C. That is very chilly. And then 6,000 years ago, North America had no ice sheets. This was the Holocene epoch, and mid-Holocene was the maximum development of plants. 5,000 years ago, there was a cooling trend which set in the Alpine glaciers. That's the mountaintop glaciers that were formed. And then from 15th to 19th century, there was something called the Little Ice Age in Europe. And then 1900 to 1945, that would cover both World War I and World War II, there was a 0.5 degree C temperature increase. And then mid-1970s, there was a slight cooling event. And then from the 1970s to present, there's a warming trend of 1 degree Fahrenheit or 0.6 degrees C, according to the textbook, which was written in 2016. So that number could be different now. This has been termed global warming and coined that by news outlets and media. However, the more accurate way to refer to it would be climate change. And as we've just covered, climate change has happened before, and we're just in these natural cycles, and we have to be in one of those warm trends at this present time. The question is this warming trend natural, human-caused, or a little bit of both? So the climate system involves the exchange of energy and moisture across our five spheres. If you don't remember from a previous episode, the five spheres are the atmosphere, which comprises all the air on the planet, then the hydrosphere, which is all the water on the planet, and a subset of that would be the cryosphere, which is all the solid water or ice that is on the Earth's surface, and then the biosphere is all the living things on the planet, and the geosphere is all the solid things or the Earth, including rock, soil, etc. So looking at a schematic view showing the several different components of the Earth's climate system, there are many different interactions that occur across these various components on a wide range of space and time scales, making the system very complex. This is currently being researched, so some of these may change and more may be added. So just going through a few of them, we know that there are human influences, obviously from burning and land use. Then there are changes in the amount of ice-covered land. There's changes in amount of cloud cover, which would obviously affect our temperatures. There's changes in atmospheric composition. There's biosphere-atmosphere interactions, whether it's like forest to air, the trees breathing in and out, that's going to be that biosphere-atmosphere interaction. It can also be the animals, the creatures. Also, we have changes in the amount of evaporation precipitation. Could it be more dry in some places? Could it be more wet in other places? Changes in the amount of outgoing radiation is going to change our temperature. Changing the atmospheric circulation would change our temperature. Changes in solar outputs, which we'll cover a little bit later. Atmosphere ice interactions, the changes in the amount of sea ice, more human influence from cities, cars, and biosphere atmosphere interactions. So in the ocean, there are a lot of creatures, some are microscopic, those interact between the atmosphere and the ocean. And then ocean atmosphere interaction. So just like we talked about El Nino, La Nina before, when those cycles occur, we know that it can influence the atmosphere as well, which causes low pressure or high pressures to form where they would not normally be. And finally, changes in ocean circulation. So those warm currents or cold currents that are normally flowing along the coastlines, if those were to stop or reverse or something like that, that would change our climate. So how do we know about the past? We use something to detect climate change called proxy data. This is based on indirect evidences. It comes from seafloor sediments, glacial ice, fossil pollen, and tree growth rings, as well as historical documents. And the people who study this are called paleoclimatologists, and these are the scientists who reconstruct past climates and are engaged in paleoclimatology. So, for example, geologic history from the Precambrian to the Paleozoic, Mesozoic to Cenozoic, which is where we are now and millions of years ago, all of these have been reconstructed from the past. Obviously, nobody was around in the Precambrian time, which was over 500 million years ago, but there's no people then. So we have to get that from indirect evidences. And in the case of geology, it usually comes from fossils. So for climate, we have to be a little bit more creative sometimes. And we're going to go through each of those proxy data. So one such proxy data is ancient bristlecone pines. Some of these trees in California's White Mountains are more than 4,000 years old. That's one tree, 4,000 years old. Think of the things that they've been through. The study of tree growth rings is one way that scientists will reconstruct past climates. Another such proxy data is seafloor sediment, and these are considered to be a storehouse of climate data since the sediment contains the dead near-surface organisms that then accumulate on the seafloor. We use drilling vessels like the one referred to in the book as the shikyu, which means earth in Japanese. Apologies if I'm saying that wrong. And it drills into the seafloor. It's a state-of-the-art scientific drilling vessel. It can drill as deep as 2,000 meters or nearly 23,000 feet below the seabed, and water as deep as 2,500 meters or 8,200 feet, which is, as you know, more than a mile deep. It is part of the Integrated Ocean Drilling Program. And it is a monstrous ship, super huge, and carries all the scientists to the locations where then they drill and perform their analysis. Another such proxy data is oxygen isotope analysis, and this analysis measures the ratio between O16 common water and O18 heavy water in the ocean. There are more O18 or heavy water during glacial times, and there's more O16 or common water during interglacial periods. So how do we find this out? It is derived from calcium carbonate of shells. That ratio is calculated. It forms in tiny stones in the inner ear of fish, which are called otoliths. As they grow, they extract the oxygen from the water, so the oxygen isotope analysis can then provide us with a possible temperature for that period of time when the fish existed. So looking at kind of a cycle of this, the water slightly depleted in O18 or the heavy water would evaporate from the warm subtropical waters, and heavy O-rich water, the heavy water, condenses over the mid-latitudes, and near the poles, the atmospheric water vapor is increasingly depleted from that heavy water, the O18, and then snow in the interior of Antarctica, for example, has 5% less O18 or heavy water than the ocean water, and then the meltwater from the glacial ice is depleted in O18. So more of it is going to be in the water during the glacial period. Another proxy is recorded through glacial ice. So we take ice cores. The scientist in the picture that I have is slicing through an ice core that's from Antarctica for this analysis. There are scientists that live in Antarctica, not year-round, but during like a select period of time. One of my friends actually did it and sent me a postcard from Antarctica, which is pretty cool. See what I did there. So he's wearing protective clothing and a mask to minimize contamination of the sample, and chemical analysis of ice cores can provide us important information and data about our past climate. These ice cores are then stored in the National Ice Core Laboratory. It is a physical plant for storing and studying cores of ice taken from glaciers around the world. These cores represent a long-term record of material deposited from the atmosphere. The lab enables scientists to examine the ice cores and preserves the integrity of these samples. Basically, it's a giant freezer, and this repository is for the study of global climate change and past environmental conditions. A graph that was made from the oxygen isotope analysis of ice cores recovered from the Greenland ice sheet shows temperature variations over the past 40,000 years, and it shows kind of the temperature hovering around negative 40 degrees, which is still very, very, very cold, from 40,000 years until about 10,000 years before present. Then there's a dramatic upturn, and now the temperature near present hovers around negative 5 degrees C. The next proxy data is called dendrochronology, and it comes from the word dendro, which means tree, and chronology meaning time. Tree rings provide the dating and study of tree rings. So tree rings provide archives of environmental history, meaning that the thick tree rings indicate favorable conditions for growth for the tree, and thin tree rings indicate unfavorable growth conditions. Of course, this is only useful in regions that experience an annual cycle and in trees that are stressed by temperature or moisture during their growing season. And we don't have to chop down the tree in order to get a sample. You can get a borehole sample, which is kind of like pricking your finger and extracting blood from a human being. The tree will recover from the borehole sample, and we are able to extract that data safely. Another proxy data is analyzing fossil pollen, and this is done with an electron microscope. It is possible then to obtain high-resolution records of vegetation changes in a given area. Another such proxy data is coral reefs. So corals actually record sea surface temperatures, and they thrive in warm, shallow tropical waters. They live on top of the foundation established from the previous coral. So a chemical analysis of the changing composition can show useful data on past near surface temperatures of our water. And we have a graph of 350 years of record of sea surface temperatures from the Galapagos Islands, and it basically averages about to 24.5 degrees C. Now, if the temperature gets above a certain temperature, then the coral reef can actually suffer something called bleaching, and eventually the coral might perish. So this is a very sensitive issue right now in the climate community. Next we have historical data. Sometimes it can contain weather information, but it doesn't actually lend itself immediately to climate analysis. Basically, these are track records for harvest times, frost dates, if there were drought periods, what the crop yields were, usually from farmers. So this kind of historical information is very useful, but again, only for like one location. Other types of proxy data include natural lake bottom sediment or soil deposits, pollen in deep ice caves, soil deposits and sea sediment, coral beds, sand dunes, and fossils that can indicate changes in water levels, historical documents of droughts and crop yields, dating stalactites in caves, borehole temperature profiles inverted for past temperature changes, and finally, heavy hydrogen or deuterium ratios in ice cores. Also, the rate of change for glaciers can be measured, and one French scientist who did so found that the glacier moves approximately 2 feet every day or 1 inch an hour, which is very, very slow. Okay, now we switch gears. We're going to talk about the natural causes of climate change. I'm going to go through plate tectonics, volcanic activity, variations in Earth's orbit, and solar variability. And some of this will be geology and the other will be a little bit of astronomy. First up, we have plate tectonics. So tectonic plates actually move very slowly and produce very gradual changes. So each of the continents has kind of a plate of rock that it's sitting on, and over time it moves across the world. A long time ago, it used to be called Pangaea because all of the continents were together. You might have noticed on a world map that South America looks like it fits in Africa's west coast. So that is kind of the idea that gave rise to this Pangaea and plate tectonics theory. And it explains similar fossils on different continents and the arrangement of the current ocean currents. And as our plates move, we have CO2, or carbon dioxide, that's being released as it pulls apart. There's more carbon dioxide coming up from the ocean floor, and less volcanic activity leads to less CO2 in the atmosphere. Another natural cause of climate change would be volcanic activity. Major eruptions actually eject material into the atmosphere. This material then filters out solar radiation. It also lowers the temperature in the troposphere. The Mount St. Helens eruption in 1980 lowered the temperature of the globe by 0.1 degrees C. It doesn't sound like a lot, but for one volcano, that's kind of significant. El Chichon in 1982 lowered the temperature of the globe by 0.3 to 0.5 degrees C, and Mount Pinatubo in 1991 lowered the temperature by 0.5 degrees C. These were so significant that satellites that were in space monitoring the Earth's surface actually have to be adjusted for these eruptions. The net solar radiation percent change during these two eruptions was almost 5% for El Chichon, and for Pinatubo it was over 3% negative incoming solar radiation, so that ejected material blocking out the solar radiation coming in from space. You can see sulfur dioxide emitting from Mount Etna from space, and it looks like a plume of smoke coming off of the Sicily island, south of Italy, well, southwest of Italy, and haze from volcanic eruptions will eventually encircle the entire planet through the winds and currents of the atmosphere. Moving on to the astronomical reasons for natural causes of climate change, we'll talk about the variations in the Earth's orbit as first hypothesized by Serbian scientist Milutin Milankovic. He used a mathematical model based on several different elements and came up with something called eccentricity, which is the variations in the shape of the Earth's orbit around the Sun. It changes from elliptical, which is where we are now, to circular every 100,000 years. Next is the changes in obliquity, that is the changes in the angle of the axis. Changes in the axis range from 22 degrees to 24.5 degrees on a 41,000 year cycle. Smaller tilt means there's less change in seasons and vice versa. Finally, precession, which is the wobbling of the Earth's axis, happens every 23,000 years, so eventually July is closest to the Sun instead of January 4th. Another astronomical factor would be the solar variability and climate. So sunspots are huge magnetic storms on the sun's surface. They eject large numbers of particles that interact with gases in the Earth's upper atmosphere. They are on average approximately on a 11-year cycle between high and low activity. Low sunspot activity has been identified with colder periods in North America and Europe during the wintertime, and sunspots have been recorded on record since 1700. And actually, sunspots were first discovered by Galileo Galilei in 1612 when he had pointed his new version of a telescope towards the heavens. Sunspots have also been linked to periods of drought in the western United States, which coincide with the 22-year magnetic cycle of the sun. The last peak of mean annual sunspots was roughly around 2002, and the last minimum was roughly 2008, and we are predicted to be entering a higher period of sunspots soon. Now we turn our attention to the possible human impact on global climate. It's been well talked about the addition of carbon dioxide to the atmosphere, so I will pass on that. However, cars and humans are not the only way to introduce more carbon dioxide to the atmosphere. Also, altering the ground cover. So if I slash and burn, it's going to change the albedo of that surface. It'll also change the evaporation rate since there's no longer trees there, and it will alter surface wind patterns. So such changes to the environment can cause feedback effects. So let's say the snow changes, then it will change the albedo, which is the reflectivity, which then increases the temperature and causes the snow and ice to melt, which then decreases the albedo, and more solar energy will come in, and then the whole cycle will repeat. And this is called a positive feedback mechanism. More on that later. So speaking of the rising CO2 levels, the higher levels are due to burning of fossil fuels and deforestation. Some of the excess is taken up by plants or dissolved in oceans. The U.S. energy consumption from 2012 shows a total of 95 quadrillion BTUs, and that's the energy unit. A quadrillion is 10 raised to the 12th power, or a million, and the burning of fossil fuels represents slightly more than 82% of the total. Unfortunately, renewable energy and nuclear power are less than 20%. So renewable energy by itself is 8% of the total, with biomasses being 50% of that, so 4% of the total, and then hydroelectric and wind, geothermal, and solar all coming in at less than 4% of the total. So hopefully we will want those renewable sources to be increasing in the near future. So looking at the CO2 concentrations, or carbon dioxide concentrations, over the past 400,000 years, remember that most of this data is coming from proxy data, which is an analysis of air bubbles trapped in ice cores. The record since 1958 comes from direct observations made at Mauna Loa Observatory in Hawaii. The rapid increase in CO2 since the onset of the Industrial Revolution is quite obvious, with a extreme jump upwards on the graph. So the real issue is, what is the atmosphere's response to said increase in CO2? And from 1880 to 2013, with the exception of 1998, 10 of the warmest years of this 134-year temperature record have occurred since 2000. So temperature projections have been made to the year 2100 based on the atmosphere's response. The right half of the graph shows projected global temperatures based on different emission scenarios. The shaded zone adjacent to each colored line shows the uncertainty range for each scenario. The basis for comparison, or the zero line on the graph, is the global average for the period 1980 to 1999. The orange line represents the scenario in which CO2 concentrations were held constant at values for the year 2000. Some of these different scenarios include business as usual, doubling CO2, or again, holding values constant over time. All of them show a rise in temperature by the year 2100. Now, CO2 is not the only gas that we should be concerned about. There are also trace gases in the atmosphere, and these are atmospheric gases with concentrations that are much lower than CO2, some examples being methane and nitrous oxide, which we covered in the air pollution episode, and also chlorofluorocarbons, which is hard to say, so we abbreviate that CFCs, and all of these absorb wavelengths of outgoing radiation from the Earth. And seen over time, both methane and nitrous oxide, until present, show very minimal fluctuations until the Industrial Revolution. Till present. Now, we already talked about where nitrous oxide came from in the previous episode. Basically, it's the burning high-temperature combustion of fossil fuels, but we did not speak about methane, which comes from places like flooded paddy fields for growing rice, also the mining of coal and drilling for oil and natural gas, because methane is a product of their formation. Also, there could be a link between methane formation in agriculture, and as the population increases around the world, so do the number of cattle and rice paddies, and hence methane. Also, we talked about aerosols before. Aerosols are tiny liquid and solid particles that are suspended in the air. Natural sources include wildfires, dust storms, breaking waves, and volcanoes. However, human-generated aerosols come from the combustion of fossil fuels and burning vegetation, and something called black carbon is soot generated from these combustion processes and fires, some of which can be seen from space, a satellite image from China into the Pacific Ocean shows a plume of about 200 kilometers or 125 miles wide by more than 600 kilometers or 375 miles long of human-generated aerosols. Good thing we have the Pacific Ocean between us and the Asian continent. Otherwise, we'd have a lot more pollution. Okay, so back to climate feedback mechanisms. This is when one or more component of the climate system is altered. Scientists then must consider many possible outcomes from that altered one. Types of feedback mechanisms include positive and negative. An example of positive feedback would be an increase in temperature, then leads to snow melting, which then reduces the albedo, which causes more solar energy to come in and be received, and then it repeats the cycle, which reinforces the initial change, making it a positive feedback mechanism. A negative feedback mechanism produces results that are just the opposite of the initial change. So let's say there was more IR radiation, which slows the rise in temperature, which then stabilizes the planet. That would be a negative feedback mechanism. So let's talk about computer models of climate. They are important yet imperfect tools. Mathematical models are simplified versions of the very real climate, and the Earth's climate system is very complex. It is difficult to model all possible variables, so they use these to separate the human and natural influences on the climate. So in the graph that I have here, the blue band shows how global average temperatures would have changed due to natural forces only, as simulated by the computer model, and it shows kind of a temperature hovering around 56.5 degrees Fahrenheit. The pink band then shows the model projections as affected by natural and human forces combined, and that one shows a much more dramatic trend upwards from starting from 1900 at roughly 56.25 degrees Fahrenheit and increases by 2000 to 58 degrees Fahrenheit. And the black line shows the actual observed global average temperatures, and we see that although not perfect, the models using both natural and human forces definitely seems to fit the observed line much better, and the bands of color are used to express the range of uncertainty, so it's not just like a line, it's a band, which gives you like this range of plus or minus and some sort of degree of error. By the way, the models that are used as predicting climate are called general circulation models, or GCMs. They include many different variables, including temperature, rainfall, snow cover, soil moisture, winds, clouds, sea ice, and ocean circulation. And these are being developed now, so more components will be added to these systems over time as they're researched. So let's talk about some consequences of climate change. So first up, we have sea level rise. So the slope of a shoreline is going to be important for that. The slope of the shoreline is critical to determine the degree to which the sea level changes will affect it. A sea level gradually changes, so the shoreline retreats, and structures that were once thought to be safe from wave attack then become vulnerable. So if I have somewhere where the slope is much more gentle, then a small rise in sea level causes a substantial shift in the original shoreline to the new shoreline based on the sea level rise, whereas a slope that is steep and the same amount of sea level rise would cause a smaller shift from the original shoreline. So the Arctic is changing. We have a loss of Arctic sea ice, which is representing a positive feedback mechanism. And then we have permafrost, which is decreased, which is also representing a positive feedback mechanism. And permafrost, if you don't know, is semi-permanently frozen ground. People have built their houses on permafrost, and now that it is thawing out, their houses are being, if not destroyed, severely damaged. And also, the ocean acidity is increasing because CO2 is being sequestered in it, which then decreases the pH, which has effects on the biosphere and ocean creatures. So there are plenty of potentials for surprises, since climate change can bring unexpected results. So based on the fifth assessment report of climate change in 2013, the 21st century climate trends show the following projected changes in estimated probability, with a couple of examples of projected impacts. So firstly, we know higher maximum temperatures will mean more hot days and heat waves over nearly all of our land areas, both northern and southern hemisphere, which is virtually certain, as they put it, which means we could have an increased incidence of death and serious illness in older age groups and urban poor, increased heat stress in livestock and wildlife, a shift in tourist destinations, which is such a tragedy, right? An increased risk of damage to a number of crops, increased electric cooling demand, and reduced energy supply reliability. Also, we'll be having, so a lot of people talk about the maximum temperatures. Nobody's really talking about the minimum temperatures, so the minimum temperatures will also be increasing, which means fewer cold days, fewer frost days, and cold waves over nearly all of the land areas, and this is again what they call virtually certain, which means a decreased amount of cold-related human mortality, which is a good thing, decreased risk of damage to a number of crops, and increased risk to others, because that heat stress will be more of a factor as opposed to frost damage, and an extended range in activity for some pest and disease vectors, which I've talked about in a different episode, so check that out, and a reduced heating energy demand, which is, again, I think a good thing. Now, the frequency of heavy precipitation events increasing over most areas is considered very likely, although this one is a little bit less certain, I would say, than the temperatures. Precipitation is harder to predict. So they're saying there could be increased flooding, landslides, avalanches, and mud flow damage, increased soil erosion, increased discharge for floodplains, aquifers due to increased runoff, and an increased pressure on government and private flood insurance systems and disaster relief agencies. And along those lines, they expect areas afflicted by drought to increase. This is a little bit less likely, and they're not so sure about this one, but it could lead to decreased crop yields, increased damage to building foundations caused by ground shrinkage, decreased water resource quantity and quality. That one's the one that we should really be concerned about. Is there going to be enough water for people? And there's a whole book about that that I can recommend. And increased risk of wildfires, which we seem to have been seeing in recent times. Okay, so the last one is very controversial, but it says increases in intense tropical cyclone activity. And if this is the case, then it would lead to increased risks to human life, the risk of infectious disease epidemics from the aftermath, and many other risks, then increased coastal erosion and damage to coastal buildings and infrastructure, plus increased damage to coastal ecosystems such as coral reefs and mangroves. Another possible consequence being glacial retreat. I have two images here taken 63 years apart from the same vantage point in Alaska's Glacier Bay National Park. The Muir Glacier, which is named after John Muir, who was essential in creating the national parks in the United States. The 1941 photo, you can see the glacier pretty clearly, and then in the 2004 photo, the glacier is completely out of view. And the Riggs Glacier in the upper right of the photo has also thinned significantly and retreated. And finally, we're tracking some sea ice changes. So sea ice is frozen seawater. In winter, the Arctic Ocean is completely ice covered. In the summer, a portion of that melts. And the map that I have here shows the extent of sea ice in early 2012, September, compared to the median minimum extent from 1979 until 2000. And the extent in 2012 was the lowest on record through the year 2013. And the sea ice that does not melt in the summer is now getting thinner. And this has been recorded using a satellite imagery since 1980, showing a direct trend line going downward into the present time. So again, although in the past we've seen changes, it seems like the change we're experiencing now seems to be at a rate of change in amount that is different than in the past. And remember that there are potential for surprises. So we'll just have to see what happens next. So I hope you've enjoyed listening to Meteorology in Real Life. Feel free to subscribe, and hopefully I'll see you next time.